Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Well, good morning, everyone. It's been quite a night. I was up feverishly working away at our latest legislation. This one's a big one. This is the Vaccine Manufacturer Full Product Liability Restoration Act of 2021. In other words, my effort to reverse the current situation with vaccine manufacturers where they're not liable for anything. They can do pretty much whatever they want. They can, you know, any number of people can be killed or injured by this current set of genetic vaccine RNA messenger coded, who knows what they are. I mean, nobody really knows. They're just experimenting with the world population and convincing you that, well, this is necessary. You know, if you don't get this shot, then, well, you can't go to the movies, you can't go out, you can't work, you can't go to stores, you know, you can't lead your normal life until you buy back your God-given rights by taking this government-imposed thing. Right? Anyway, so I thought the least we could do is to reverse this and make these folks fully liable for what they're doing. And now, can I do that just writing this legislation? No. It's, you know, it's a little more complicated than that, you know, because Congress is bought and paid for by Big Pharma. What I want to do is with this and with a lot of our citizen legislation is basically show you how easy it would be to change it. All right. Basically, I turned the shall not be liable to shall be liable in law. And it's Title 42. Well, I got the preamble to it here. So let me tell you what I wrote, and then we'll get onto the election correction report because I've got a ton of information on that too. We've got Chief Dan Skyhorse joining us at the bottom of the hour. We've got a couple of folks, Jimmy T. Smith and Michaela Rollo Kerwin, who are going to join us from Concerned Veterans for America. We're going to talk about the national debt. Now, I have to sort of apologize. I got sort of so wrapped up in my vaccine bill that there's a few things I want to look up. So I might be following up, depending on how much material they have on this. I'll probably be looking up some different things because my favorite president when it comes to the national debt is Calvin Coolidge, who cut federal spending pretty much in half, you know, and then cut the national debt pretty much in half. And the result of that was the Roaring Twenties. So if he can do it, we can do it. You know, it's a willpower thing, but it's really tough to do when you have you had a $2 trillion stimulus last year, you had another $2 trillion stimulus this year. They're talking about another $2 trillion infrastructure package. And the ultra leftists in Congress are saying, well, that's not ambitious enough. We really need to spend $10 trillion. Well, the entire U.S. economy isn't that big. You know, they're talking the staggering amount of money that $1 trillion is. Is amazing. And the amount of debt these people are adding, I think that it's kind of like a drug. It's like, well, the last dose didn't kill me. Let's see how far we can push this. Let's see how more we can take. You know, I bumped up and then I bumped again and then I bumped again, you know, take the hit that I was given, whatever that song, you know, the song I'm talking about, right? So this is what's going on here. These people are on drugs. I mean, they're seriously, they're running on adrenaline and they think, hey, look at this. We spent $1 trillion and got away with it. Well, let's try two. We got $2 trillion and got away with it. Well, why don't we just go for 10? You know, and it just never stops. And the only way to stop this is to stop them and get them out. But that's kind of hard to do when the election is stolen, and which brings us to the Georgia law. And I'll get to that in just a little bit. Pianchi, one of our regular callers, who really I'm going to retitle as our Action Radio commentator. And so Pianchi, you now have the status of commentator, so I will introduce you as such next time you call, because he does so much work for the show behind the scenes, and just, you know, we chat about stuff, and it's really quite interesting, the amount of things, and you'll see it on Facebook too. We're always going back and forth with different issues and things. All right, so I wrote this bill last night. It's been in my head for months. It's going to go to Robert Francis Kennedy Jr. at Children's Health Defense. I've already posted it to our vaccine, Action Radio Vaccine Project. It's on the Zelenko Action Radio Coronavirus Clearinghouse. You know, it's in our citizen, you know, Center for Citizen Legislation Facebook page. I've gone to conservative writers. I've sent this to a bunch of different places already and some folks that are very involved in vaccine information distribution for you folks. Now, the problem is, a lot of times it's a little hard to get past the Facebook censors, but they're not geared up for citizen legislation. They haven't caught up to me yet, and I hope they don't, because this is a great way for us to get information to you. And again, legislation is citizen legislation. First and foremost is education. It shows you what is possible. It shows you what can be done, and it really shows you how easily it can be done. This is a, you know, like a two-page, you know, thing. Most of my bills are very short, and I don't write them all, by the way. I write a fair amount of them because, you know, it's kind of my thing. But a lot of folks will then comment on this bill. We'll do revisions. We'll add different sections. I just realized there's a section I have to add on Azar. I don't know if he's still there at Food and Drug Administration. You know, maybe he's gone back to his big pharma job. Who knows? But they had a special coronavirus thing that they put in the Federal Register to give the coronavirus vaccines a special set of immunity. I have to take that out too. So I have to cancel that. So I've got to put that in the bill as well. So it's not finished, but it's, you know, I mean, all these bills are works in progress. So let me get to this, then I'll tell you about the Georgia report. We'll see how much time we have for the other reports. So the rationale for this bill that I wrote, which is the Vaccine Manufacturer Full Product Liability Restoration Act of 2021. I said, currently vaccine manufacturers enjoy complete immunity from any product liability civil suit against any vaccine they manufacture, distribute, advertise, market, or benefit from because of any government program or action. This is insane. No other product has this blanket immunity. If vaccines are completely safe, then there should be minimal injuries and deaths. No product is perfect, and being subject to product liability laws and lawsuits should pose no significant burden. However, granting absolute immunity encourages complete recklessness and negligence, if not criminal conspiracy, to produce known dangerous products without the possibility of any legal or financial consequences, regardless of the rate of injury, severity of injury, or loss of life. That crime has to be redressed immediately. This act reverses current law and puts full product liability for vaccines where it belongs, on the manufacturers of those vaccines. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. You know, this isn't rocket science. You know, this isn't, you know, something magical, mystical. A lot of what we do here is demystify the law. So I wrote that last night. It's pretty, you know, I mean, it's right there. This isn't, you know, that big a deal, I think, in terms of, you know, one person putting some effort and writing a bill that you can rally on. Okay. So now you have to rally around it. All right. And I also post this to America's Frontline Doctors. That's Dr. Simone Gold. I sent it to Dr. Zelenko and a couple of other folks. So it's out there. I mean, it's already there. And so if you want to support this bill, the best thing you can do, read it, share it, send it to all your friends, send it to your member of Congress, send it to other media, talk about it on other talk shows. The single best, I don't fear competition. You know, if you want to talk about anything we talk about here on another show, that's fine with me. You know, especially the bills, because so much of what we do is going to require a talk show host, you know, in a big way. Because first of all, I had to teach them how to do what I do. That's good. You know, that's the whole thing right there. So we shall see. In fact, I'm trying to get a story in Talkers Magazine about what we do so that they will realize that, you know, talk radio is great. I love talk radio, but talk radio has a new future. It's called action radio, and we are the next evolution, and we will, you know, make talk radio not obsolete, but certainly its limits have been reached, I think. All right. So the election correction report. Now, a lot of folks don't really see what's going under the radar, because these stories kind of appear individually. You hear a little bit about them. I like to put them together once a week so you realize how much is going on, you know, in the idea of correcting the election. The Georgia law is the future elections. I wish they would correct their last election, you know, because nothing's really going to happen in 2022 until 2020 is corrected and the true winner, the lawful president, Donald Trump, is put back in the White House, you know, through a peaceful transition. We'll see how peaceful it is with Antifa and Black Lives Matter. All right. So I was looking around for a decent article on the Georgia bill because there's so much misinformation. The most disgusting example of lies about the Georgia bill, the election reform, is what insurrectionist Joe Biden said when he said that people can't get food and water while they're waiting in lines out in the hot Georgia sun, you know, waiting at the polls. Well, that's a total lie. But the logic is that people can't just walk up to folks who are waiting to vote because, you know, who's to say they're not from a campaign? Who's to say that bottle of water, you know, doesn't come with $50 to vote for a particular candidate? You know, you don't know. And that's why poll workers are the ones who should distribute water and food at tables, not anybody just walking up to people who are getting ready to vote. There are very strict laws about how close you can get to a polling station when you are campaigning. And if you're walking up to people waiting in line, you know, with something to offer them, a bribe, you know, for example, that's not only a crime, but it's also several crimes, you know, bribery, vote fraud, everything else. All right. So I found this GPB news. It's actually part of PBS and NPR. So they did a pretty good job on this one. So Georgia, I guess, public broadcasting is what GPB stands for. And the article is March 27th. And it's updated March 27th by Stephen Fowler. And so this is what's going on with the Georgia law. So he says Georgia has a new slate of voting laws after Governor Brian Kemp signed SB 202, a 98-page omnibus bill on Thursday. The Election Integrity Act of 2021 was passed out of the legislature on a party-line vote, because Democrats are fraud, that's why, and makes a number of controversial changes to how elections are run in the state, but also many adjustments welcomed by local election officials who were overwhelmed by a record turnout, unprecedented shift towards mail-in voting because of the coronavirus pandemic. Okay, no, it wasn't because of the coronavirus pandemic. That was the excuse used. They wanted mail-in voting anyway. Democrats know that because Democrats 10 years ago reported on how much fraud there is in mail-in voting. So if you want to know who knows the most about election fraud, go to the people who are doing it, the Democrats, all right? Back to the article. He says, because it is such a massive piece of legislation, proponents and opponents of the bill are focusing on different sections of the law. But there are many that voters might have missed. Ultimately, Georgia voters will be impacted by most every change that is now in effect. So here's an extensive breakdown of how the voters will be affected. And this actually is pretty good. This really does this. And again, this was looking into the Georgia law was inspired by Pianki, one of our regular callers and now Action Radio commentator at large. So Pianki, you got a new title. He says, well, the article says, read Georgia's new election law. He's got changes to absentee voting. All right. This is one of the biggest problems. Absentee votes, votes that couldn't be attributed to who actually made them, not what the votes are themselves, but the ballots. You know, there's a difference between a ballot and a vote, and the ballot has to be legal, okay? Otherwise, it can't be counted. And the biggest problem was, of course, all the ballot harvesting, all the fake ballots, all the computer manipulations, all the counting of extra stuff, all the fraud that went on. And there's a litany of fraud that went on in the last election. And Georgia was one of the worst places. You know, take a look at the two Georgia senators. You know, I mean, does anybody really think Georgia elected a couple of Marxists? I don't think so. All right. So changes to absentee voting, back to the article. And I post this on my Facebook page, so if you want to take a look at it, or just go to GPB, Georgia Public Broadcasting, and look up, you know, when did I say this was? March 27th. So what, 3 days ago? 4 days ago. Anyway, this week. mail-in absentee voting, back to the article, will look more, the most different for voters, especially after 1.3 million people used that method in November's general election. Voters over 65 with a disability in the military or who live overseas will still be able to apply once for a ballot and automatically receive one the rest of an election cycle. But the earliest voters can request a mail-in ballot will be 11 weeks before an election instead of 180 days, less than half the time. The final deadline to complete an application is moved earlier too. Instead of returning an application by Friday before Election Day, SB 202 now backs it up to two Fridays before. Republican sponsors of the bill and local election officials say this will cut down on the number of ballots rejected for coming in late because of the tight turnaround. So they actually have extended some time for certain things. Now, I used to vote absentee just as a regular course of things. I did it as a provision in case I couldn't make it to the polls for some reason. You know, I always wanted to have my vote counted. But realizing now the amount of vote fraud that comes from mail-in ballots, you know, the only reason to vote absentee is if you really have to. You can't make it to the polls. And pretty much every time, you know, I think actually every time, I could have made it to the polls. And so I've canceled my absentee voter status with Santa Rosa County, you know, Registrar of Voters or Elections Office here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. You know, up in the panhandle up near actually we are in the far northwest corner of the state. And so I'm going to vote like people are supposed to vote at the polls on Election Day. And I think that's very important. So this is some of the things that are going on. Also, they say counties will also begin mailing out absentee ballots about 3 weeks later than before, starting 4 weeks before the election. Requesting and returning a ballot will also require new ID rules. And this is very important because, as we all know, ID is required for virtually everything you do. You know, people have to know companies, you know, financial institutions, place you rent a car from, you know, government has to know who you are. So there's nothing unusual about ID. The idea that this is voter suppression is insane. And I had that article by Avi. I've forgotten his last name, starts with an H. I posted on Facebook last night of how, you know, liberal white racists think that black people can't find their way to the DMV to register to vote, or, you know, can't use the internet, all this other kind of racist stuff. It really was pretty tragic to listen to because they have a serious problem. You know, white liberals, white racist liberals do have a serious problem. Anyway, so the point of all this is that they keep talking about voter suppression. Let me state this for the record. The greatest voter suppression that has ever occurred was the suppression of everybody that voted for Donald Trump, because everybody that voted for Donald Trump had their vote suppressed, quashed, made moot because the election was stolen. So let's get that clear, that there is nothing greater in terms of election and voter suppression than what happened at the 2020 election, November 3rd, when the election was stolen after 11 o'clock, when the poll workers were kicked out and when the computers kicked in and when all the votes were changed, you know, fraudulently for Joe Biden, the insurrectionist. Okay. That is voter suppression. Everything else is BS. All right. Let me get back to the article here. Requesting and returning a ballot will also require new ID rules, either your driver's license number, state ID number, or if you don't have those, a copy of acceptable voter ID. It's probably like, you know, utility bills, things like that. I don't think that was a smart idea. I think they should have gone with a driver's license or state ID, because everybody can get a driver's license or a state ID, which is basically, a state ID is basically a driver's license without the driver's license. It's the same ID form. They just don't have on it that you can, the state has approved your ability to drive. Okay. The law also, back to the article, allows for applications to be returned online after the Secretary of State's official office has launched an online request portal using your driver's license number or state ID number ahead of November's general election. Okay. Again, most of this is for the next election. They're still not cleaning up the last one. And that's something they need to do. A little bit more here, absentee ballot and envelopes will look different. SB 202 requires absentee ballots to be printed on special security paper. Yeah. All right. I'll let you read the rest of that section. I'm just going to highlight a couple of the different sections here in the interest of time. Changes to early voting. One of the biggest changes in the bill would expand early voting access for most counties, adding an additional mandatory Saturday and formally codifying Sunday voting hours as optional. Counties can have early voting open as long as 7 in the morning till 7 at night or 9 to 5 at a minimum. If you live in a larger metropolitan county, you might not notice a change. For most other counties, you will have an extra weekend day, and your weekday early voting hours will likely be longer. So much for voter suppression. They're actually opening up the process. Okay, I'll say the rest of that. You can read that. Changes to vote counting. Among complaints about the 2020 election was how long it took for some counties to release their final vote totals, how others missed batches of ballots the first time, and general confusion about why the process is not over on election night. Oh, Ben, let me focus on that. Missed batches of ballots? You know, those are probably the fraud ones, folks. All right. Back to, look, this is NPR. What do you want? You know, and PBS. So that they have to cover for their Democrat vote frauders. So that's what I think that's about. But generally, this is a pretty good article. All right. Next paragraph, a change local officials embrace is a section that allows them to begin processing, but not tabulating, not sure the difference, absentee ballots starting 2 weeks before the election. Okay. So they don't have to sort of lump everything together. I see no problem counting absentee ballots, you know, before election day, as long as you have a minimum amount of absentee ballots. In other words, you know, they have to have a reason. You have to have a really good reason to have an absentee ballot. You know, generally military deployed is one of the best reasons. But other than that, you know, if you physically can't get there, you know, then the absentee ballot makes sense. Okay. But that's a really small percentage of the population compared to the amount that the Democrats want, which is everybody voting by absentee ballot. So and then what they really want are states just mailing out random ballots everywhere so they can be taken, filled in, and you know the story. You know how this all works, right? Okay, changes affecting local election offices. One change buried in the bill would give county election officials greater flexibility with voting equipment for smaller, lower turnout races. Previous law requires one ballot marking device for every 250 active workers. Try and explain that one. All right, let me. Here's this is one of the more interesting ones here. Changes affecting the state election board. While most Georgians don't directly interact with the state election board, several changes made by the Republican legislature could have an impact on local elections offices. Yeah, that's the Raffensperger. I think he's Secretary of State, and the governor, Republican in name only, who have let just a fraud election go through. A lot of the problem is the state election board, which changed the rules, allowed for the changes in the rules, changed laws, did all kinds of things that are blatantly unconstitutional and still need to be corrected so that we can arrive at the actual legal vote total. But the article says the Secretary of State will no longer chair the state election board, becoming instead a non-voting ex officio member. That's pretty cool. The new chair would be nonpartisan, but appointed by a majority of the state House and Senate. That's how the state legislatures are now going to control the elections. Okay, the chair would not be allowed to have been a candidate, participate in a political party organization or campaign, or made campaign contributions for 2 years prior to being appointed. The law also says the governor should appoint someone if the position becomes vacant when lawmakers are not in session. Okay, well, they should definitely, the legislature should definitely appoint them. But, you didn't hear that on the news. As you heard, people were going to be, dying of thirst in line. Last little bit here, there are other more intangible changes that will not directly impact how you vote. I'll leave you to sort of, get that on your own. Okay, next article. I've got 8 minutes left. This is crazy. This was interesting. This came up, I think, a few days ago. This is Missoula, Montana. All right. And this is, let me just move this up a little bit, Real Clear Investigations. This is John Lott. John Lott is the person that looked at the gun argument, and concluded that, more guns, less crime, and wrote a book to that title. So he says a river of doubt runs through mail voting in Montana. Okay. Montana, basically conservative Republican state, except for this one place called Missoula. It says Missoula, Montana, a mountainous 2,600 square mile region with a population of approximately 119,600, does not seem like your, prototypical setting for machine politics. Yet a recent audit of mail-in ballots, see, there you go, that's what the problem is, right? Mail-in ballots cast there found irregularities characteristic of larger urban centers on a level that could easily easily swing local elections in 2020 and statewide elections in cycles past. So there you go. This is Montana. Article says the Biden administration, the Democrat-controlled Congress, and the Democrat National Committee are collectively pressing to both nationalize and make permanent many of the extraordinary pandemic-driven voting measures, implemented during the 2020 election, particularly mass mail-in voting. John Lott says political leaders and prominent media outlets have dismissed concerns raised by critics that such measures invite voter fraud. But could the election in small county Missoula call all that into question? Story at hand begins, during the pandemic summer The story at hand begins during the pandemic summer of 2020 when the then governor, Democrat Steve Bullock, issued a directive permitting counties to conduct the general election fully by mail. See, that was wrong. Okay. In the run-up to the election, a court also struck down Montana's law aimed at preventing ballot harvesting. There's your second strike. All right. Missoula, Montana's second most populous county and one of its most heavily Democratic, opted in to the universal vote by mail regime. So there's your third strike. Democrats, running the election. In response, in October 2020, several county residents with experience targeting election integrity issues formed a group to ensure the legitimacy of the 2020 vote. The members contended that Missoula County had shown anomalies in elections past. In November, the group approached State Senator Brent. Let me skip down to the things that they actually found, because we've only got a few minutes left here. I just love reading this stuff because it's fascinating. Okay, so we've got here the audit. Oh, here we go. In November, the group approached State Senator Brad Shida, a Republican, to formally take up the issue. Shida hired a lawyer involved in the group, Quentin Rhodes, to represent him in corresponding with Missoula County Elections Administrator Bradley Seaman, a Democrat appointee and a longtime supporter of progressive causes. Seaman's office complied with Sheeta's request for access to all of the county's ballot envelopes, and on January 4th, a team of volunteers overseen by Rhodes conducted an audit with the assistance of the Missoula County Elections Office. The audit consisted of both a count and review of all ballot envelopes and comparing that to the number of officially recorded votes during the November 3rd, 2020 general election. Okay, so they actually got the audit, and here's what they found. They said its conclusions were troubling. 4,592 out of the 72,491 mail-in ballots lacked envelopes. In other words, you can't tell whether they're real or votes or not. 6.33% of all votes. Without an officially printed envelope with registration information, a voter's signature, and a postmark indicating whether it was cast on time, election officials cannot verify that a ballot is legitimate. It is against the law to count such votes. What's more, according to auditors, county employees claim that during the post-election audit, some of the envelopes may have been double counted, possibly indicating an even higher number of missing envelopes. Okay. So there's more anomalies here. Let's go. I want to get down to where it actually states what the results were. All right, yeah, there's a lot here. I'm sorry for the delay. Let me play something real quick. You know, I want to get, because there's one section that tells exactly how many votes were mixed up in what they did. I want to see if I can find it real quick. I had it before, but I'll be right back.
Joe Biden's dark winter. No freedom, no liberty, no guns, no representation, no oil, no coal, no nuclear power, no space force. No constitution, no family gatherings, no vacations, just taxes, work, misery, masks, lockdowns, and ever more government. This is what will happen if you let Marxists steal the election. This has been a public service announcement of Action Radio, reminding you it's time to get off your butt and save your country.
Aha! I was wrong. I'm thinking of Windham, New Hampshire. Windham, New Hampshire is where they have these different votes, and they actually up the different titles. Let me see what's going on. I'm going to check something real quick, and I'll be right back to you. Well, I'm just going to talk to you as I'm doing this, and we'll see what I can figure out here. Okay, so yeah, I had a feeling. So I actually had more time than I thought I did. So just checking my message, and it looks like Dan's not going to be able to join us this morning, so we'll do the Creek Tribe report next week. So in the meantime, let me finish this article, take a quick break, play a couple things, and then come back with more, because I've got more articles on election fraud. We can cover that. We can talk about I'll possibly pull up the bill, or give me a call if you want to talk about this or any other issue. So for the next half hour for ourselves, and then at 8 o'clock and in half an hour, we're going to get to the report by Concerned Veterans for America. We're going to talk national debt. This is going to be fun too. This should be quite fascinating. Okay. So let me just, now that I know I have a little, it's live radio. We just roll with it, you know? So let me just go here. Let's get back to where I was. So I can get this article out here properly. You know, so you think you jump around, you're going to have it make sense, and you realize, well, wait a minute, I missed something. There's more to the story here. And so let me just back up a little bit. Yeah, that's a lot. Here we go. So Seaman's office, that's the guy here. Let me just, here. November, the group approached State Representative Brad Sheeta, a Republican, to formally take up the issue. Sheeta hired a lawyer involved in the group, Quentin Rhodes, to represent him in corresponding with Missoula County Elections Administrator Bradley Seaman, a Democrat appointee and longtime supporter of progressive causes. Okay, let me state that again so you know all the players. Seaman's office complied with Sheeta's request for access to all the county's ballot envelopes. And on January 4th, a team of volunteers overseen by Rhodes conducted an audit with the assistance of the Missoula County Elections Office. The audit consisted of both a count and review of all ballot envelopes and comparing that to the number of officially recorded votes during the November 3rd, 2020 general election. That I read you before. So here, let's get into some numbers. Its conclusions were troubling. 4,592 out of the 72,491 mail-in ballots, lacked envelopes. And I think I read that already too. So let's get to the point where it was different. What's more, according to auditors, county employees claim that during the post-election audit, some of the envelopes may have been double counted. I read that too. Auditors also tested a smaller random subsample of 15,455 mail-in envelopes for other defects. Of these, 55 lacked postmark dates and 58 never had their signatures checked. For a total of 0.7% of all ballots in the sample, no envelope had more than one irregularity. Extrapolating from the subsample, that would make more than 5,000 of Missoula County's votes, roughly 7%, with unexplained irregularities. Okay, so it doesn't sound like much, but when you start expanding it over the election, yeah, the numbers grow. Still, another issue arose during the audit that aroused auditors' suspicions. Dozens of ballot envelopes bore strikingly similar distinctive handwriting styles in the signatures, suggesting that one or several persons may have filled out and submitted multiple ballots, which is an act of fraud. One auditor asserted that of 28 envelopes reviewed from the same address, a nursing home, all 28 signatures looked exactly the same stylistically. Gee, I wonder what caused that. Right. Another auditor reported that among the envelopes she received, two very unique signatures appeared dozens of times, describing one such signature as starting out flat, moving to a peak and tapering out, and another as consisting of numerous circles, a bubble signature. Auditors were able to conduct a more comprehensive count because, they say, Missoula County election officials refused to permit them to take pictures of the signatures, and envelopes were not shared across the different tabulation tables at the audit, so reviewers could not cross-compare ballot samples. All right. So there's more. There's more to this, the article will go on. So what he says in conclusion, John Lott, what comes next for Missoula County, given the discrepancies identified? State authorities say they are concerned about the findings and may well take them up in a joint hearing of the Montana Senate and House Judiciary Committee. State representatives are also seeking to reinstate laws that would restrict ballot harvesting as well as other election reforms. Okay, so let me kind of say what I think is going on here. We had, for the most part, pretty decent election laws. Right? Those laws were completely changed using the excuse of COVID to bring about things that Democrats wanted that would allow them to steal the election, all right? And so now we're in the position of discovering all the problems, all the ways the election was stolen, and all the things, all the law changes that led up to the election being stolen, and a lot of places are trying to change that for the next time. That's good, and that's critical, and that has to be done, but the real changes we need are correcting the last election and prosecuting the people that committed the crimes. And unless that happens, there's no incentive to not cheat again. You know, if crime pays, this is basically what they're saying. You know, allowing Biden to stay in office shows that crime pays. In other words, if he can get away with it, it's okay. You know, and that can't happen. We cannot allow Biden to stay as a fraud president. We cannot allow these practices to continue. We cannot allow that people will not be prosecuted and go to jail for what they did to steal the election. And I don't care if it leads all the way up to Obama. You know, we can't have that happen. You know, so these are things that we need to fix. And so that's what's going on. Let me just play a couple things here. I'll be right back in a little bit. And I got more announcements, more stuff, we'll talk more election news. Here at Action Radio, we are looking for sponsors. We have 30 and 60-second spots available for your announcements. And we have 3-minute live call-ins to talk about your products and services available. Action Radio is the next evolution beyond talk radio. Join us and let us help your business evolve. Think about being a sponsor of the future and not just a listener, and help us help your business grow as you help us plunge headlong into breaking new ground here on Action Radio every day. Oh, that's no fun. My computer lost my connection to my mouse here for a second. Okay, I can fix that. There we go. I'll be right back. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Pankless Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. Part of the fun of live radio is when your gas cylinder in your chair starts getting weaker and you sink down. You have to kind of reach up at the microphone. That's kind of where I am now. So it looks like I need to replace some essential studio equipment here. All right, continuing on with our theme. Again, if you want to talk to me, 215-383-3832. The town of Windham, New Hampshire, incorporated 1742, has another election correction report. And this comes to us from, let's see if I can find these, Uncover DC. I guess they don't have it at the top of the article. So uncoverdc.com, great source of information. And they've got this here. House Election Law Committee approves forensic audit of November 3rd election in Windham, New Hampshire. And this is from Michelle Edwards. And it's the date is March 25th. So all this stuff just happened last week. And again, you start looking at this in total. You've got Missoula, Montana. You've got Windham, New Hampshire. You've got Georgia. You've got all these places. And we still haven't heard, you know, the latest in Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin, you know, or Pennsylvania for that matter. So all these different places are doing stuff. And that doesn't count the court cases that are still in process and everything else is happening. So don't even think for a second this is over, you know. And I'm still waiting for that first state to say, you know what, we screwed up. The wrong person got elector sent. You know, we're rescinding the Biden electors, the fraudulent ones, and awarding our electors to Donald Trump. And the minute that happens, everything's going to change. And I can't wait. I see that as the only way out of this. Now, whether it'll happen, I don't know. It's going to take guts and it's going to take willpower. That's what should happen. That's where we're headed right now. But the guarantees, no, there's no way to guarantee that. All right, so let's go back to our article here. In a step towards establishing election integrity in New Hampshire, the entire New Hampshire House Election Law Committee, led by Chairperson Barbara Griffin, who is a Republican of Goffstown, G-O-F-F-S, town, unanimously voted to authorize a forensic audit, those are the good ones, of voting machines and ballots in the town of Windham. On March 11th, on a 20-0 vote, the panel approved and sent to the full House a wholly rewritten version of Senate Bill SB 43 that passed on a vote 24-0 February 18th. Responding to pleas from Windham residents and with strong support from Senator Robert Guida, that's a Republican of Warren, who has tirelessly represented Windham's voice at the state level, Secretary of State William Gardner eventually listened to voter concerns and recognized the importance of performing an independent forensic audit on the town's voting machines and ballots. What is it about these secretaries of state? Are they like, I don't know, George Soros district attorneys? Are they all corrupt? Is this just in a position appointed to, you know, buds of the governor? Are they a rubber stamp for, you know, just all these vote fraud measures? This is what it seems to be. So if you really want to reform your state, one of the places you might want to look is your Secretary of State office. You might want to sort of redo the charter, redo the job description, or give them a lot less power, or just abolish the office completely and throw everything into the election committees of the state legislature, which is probably where this should be. I'm not sure a Secretary of State, given their track record, is an office that a state necessarily needs. So there's something to think about, too. Okay, so we're here we go. The new bill would direct the audit team to determine whether, back to the article, whether Windham's four Dominion AccuVote OS optical scanners, which are the only optical scanners municipalities are permitted by law to use, and I imagine that's New Hampshire, function correctly. What's the point of having a Dominion voting machine that functions correctly? You can't steal the vote if it functions correctly. Or maybe it does function correctly to do that. Anyway, let's see what they say. In the November 3rd election, and whether the number of ballots counted by hand in Windham and those counted by the Secretary of State during the recount on November 12th match the number of ballots cast. Okay, so this is the one I was getting confused with Missoula, Montana. All right, so you have this stuff swirling in your head. It's amazing where it goes. All right. So the measure is the latest development to address a controversy that emerged after the November 12th recount of Windham's Rockingham County District 7 race, which took almost 6 hours and produced peculiar results. Aren't you curious? I am. Candidate Christy St. Laurent calls for a recount. Julius Soti, that's a Republican, originally finished fourth in the race. earning the final state representative seat for Windham. I guess they have four representatives, all right? The sole town in the district, okay? So he defeated Democrat Christy St. Laurent by just 24 votes. Due to the close margin, St. Laurent, asked for a recount. During the November 12th recount, the numbers changed drastically, with each Republican candidate gaining, are you ready for this? Each Republican candidate gaining approximately 300 votes. Gee, where'd they come from? Okay. Did this somehow get dropped? Did this somehow get not counted? Well, what a surprise. It's always the Republicans that have the lower vote count and the Democrats that get the higher vote count. That can't be a coincidence unless you're totally, just mindlessly for the Democrats. All right. Soda gained 297. Bob Lim gained 303. Representative Charles McMahon, not the wrestling guy, gained 298. And Representative Mary Griffin gained 299. Lawrence, oh, that was St. Laurent, ultimately lost 99 votes on the recount, while her three fellow Democrat candidates gained 21, 28, and 18. Once completed, Soda kept the fourth spot and final spot, with his vote total increasing from 24 to 420. This is comical. But anyway, all these articles are on my Facebook page, so you can take a look at them. But this is hysterical. This little town, all right? But these little towns, see, here's what I think's going on. This is why I think this is so fascinating. The little towns, that little town in Wisconsin, Michigan, excuse me, Allenburg, Allentown, there's a little town in Wisconsin, which is predominantly Republican, which all of a sudden had all these Democrats win, and more people vote than are eligible to vote in their town. Okay, so that stood out. So, you know, the big cities, they're hiding stuff. It's easy to hide stuff in the big cities because there's too many people, too many problems. Nobody knows what's really going on. The voter rolls are hash. I mean, they really are. They're just a mess. But in these small towns, they're like, wait a minute, they can actually count people. People actually know each other in these small towns. So what they're finding is the anomalies in the small towns, they're sort of, you know, using that as a sample to project what's really going on in the big cities. And it's fascinating. So you know, why would you cheat in a small town? First of all, you're an idiot. It's too easy to find, unless you're arrogant. So the arrogance of the Democrats is being found out in these small towns, and then that's being extrapolated out to the bigger cities, and people are now looking at the big cities, and they're getting what they call forensic audits. Those are the good ones. They look at the ballot. They look at the envelope. They look at the voting machine. They look at everything. It's great, as opposed to recounting fraudulent ballots that have already been counted. You know, recounting fraudulent ballots does nothing. Recounts are useless, all right? So people say, well, we're going to recount. Well, that doesn't matter, because unless you're checking each ballot and doing a forensic audit along the way, you're going to get the same fraudulent result you got the first time. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Anyway, back to the article. Initially reluctant to get involved, SOS, I guess Secretary of State Gardner, assumed the miscount was likely the result of human error. Yeah, right. In either adding the totals on election night or transcribing the final results for transmission to the Secretary of State's office. Oh, really? Somebody made a little penmanship error? Anyway, New Hampshire law permits only one recount in any given race. To challenge the results further, a candidate must file an appeal with the Ballot Law Commission, which St. Laurent did. On November 23rd, the Ballot Law Commission spent several hours deliberating the appeal, hearing testimony from St. Laurent. Okay. Anyway. So the Secretary of State's office and others, as well as inspecting each of the 34 absentee ballots that were rejected, ultimately they upheld the results of the recount, but requested an investigation by the Attorney General's office, which has now been undertaken. Okay, so this goes on. There's a lot more to the story here. Just a little bit more I want to give you. Wyndham's unwavering concern over election integrity. The 603 Alliance, along with community activists like Ken Earing, a 22-year resident of Wyndham who owns a software company and is a former chair of the Wyndham School Board, have been actively involved in getting to the bottom of the election debacle, a disturbance they have named the Wyndham Incident. Okay. So anyway, there's more to the story. It's a long article. It goes on with more details. But let me just get the last paragraph here to kind of sum this up. Once the audits are completed, the forensic team will deliver a report of their findings, recommended procedures, and remedies. The Wyndham community is looking for answers to every question they have and want nothing to be overlooked regarding vote tallies and matching performance, in other words, software, memory cards, hardware. Earing commented, the citizens of Wyndham are demanding a report that is the caliber of the Antrim County, Antrim County, Michigan forensic report, and anything less will be unacceptable. So this raises another really interesting point too, because what's happening is a lot of these different counties are looking at other counties across the country. Well, what did they do in Antrim? What did they do right? Well, let's do that here. And then the next county will say, well, what did they do in Windham, New Hampshire? That's pretty cool. Let's take a look at that in Georgia. You know, well, what did Georgia do right? And all these things are piggybacking off each other. And we still don't hear from the courts. You know, we still got more stuff going on there. You know, and it's fascinating to me, you know, all these things that are happening. And you look at them in total. And you look at the aggregate that's going on and the staggering lack of coverage, you know, that's going on in the major media right now. I find this fascinating as to what's going on. It's really incredible. Got a call here. Want to check that out? Let me play you one more thing, and I'll be right back to you in a little bit. Hopefully someone wants to join me. But, yeah, I'm tired of talking. Enough about me. I want to hear from you guys. Anyway, be right back. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. Okay, what I'm going to do, where'd it go? Ah, there we go. That's better. Michaela Kerwin's on the line right now. She's calling in a bit early for 8 o'clock. I just want to check in and see if you want to chat about election corrections, or do you want to wait till 8 o'clock until your regular report?
I'll wait until our regular report. I was calling in to listen to you.
Okay. Well, and like I say, all folks are welcome to do that. You can do that at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Generally, if you call in, I'll talk to you. All right. Let me put you back on hold. I'll get back to you at 8 o'clock. And that's how that works. So let me get back to the last article I have here on this, on the election correction, is the Wisconsin Assembly authorizes investigation of 2020 presidential election. And this is from March 24th. So what's today? The 30th? What was March 24th? Make sure that was... So last week, yes, that's a week ago. So this completes our week of election correction reports. This is Joseph Curl, March 24th, DailyWire.com. Daily Wire is doing some fantastic work with the election corrections, and I think you'll find this all quite fascinating. So here's the article. Let's scroll down a little bit here. Here we go. The Wisconsin Assembly has passed a resolution authorizing an investigation into the 2020 presidential election that they say President Joe Biden is like, no, sorry, wrong. I'm calling him insurrectionist Joe Biden now. One, but former President Donald Trump sued over forcing the state into a recount. Again, as I said, recounts, if you're only counting the fraudulent ballots, you're not accomplishing anything because you're going to get the same result. If you're doing a forensic audit and counting only the legal ballots, that's where the work comes in. Let's get Pianca in the line here. So, Pianca, I got a new title for you. You're going to be Action Radio Commentator at Large. How's that sound?
It sounds very good. And good. I want to bring out a couple of things. You know, when you read the changes that's being done with the methods on how Georgia go about, I didn't hear anything that was changed or put in place that would deny blacks the right to vote. Like Joe Biden came out and called it a Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Applied Jim Crow to what's going on.
Gee, how racist of Georgia not to address that so directly. Yeah, no, that's hysterical, and if you don't like the truth of what Georgia's doing, lie about it. If you don't like the truth about election fraud, lie about it. And so you're absolutely right. So let's talk about that black suppression of votes. As I made the comment earlier, the greatest suppression of votes in American history was the suppression of everybody who voted for Donald Trump because the election was stolen. It doesn't get bigger than that. That's my contention.
Well, you're absolutely right. And for him to use terms like that, which mm-hmm. was a dire period in portions of this country, in the South, and maybe some cities in the North that affected mm-hmm. blacks to keep them from voting, for him to use a term like that without showing how he can substantiate it. And the one change that they always, what they have referred to is the fact that, well, you can't give people water and food that's standing in line to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some connotations that go with that also as it applies to black, but I won't get into it right now. But
no. Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, when you look at what it takes in proven documentation is to cash in a Georgia lotto ticket, the stipulations are higher than what it is to vote.
That is hysterical. Well, and, you know, and here's the thing too. You know, so how long is this going to go on, Pianki? How long are Black Americans going to sit back and let this kind of racist propaganda, this characterization that Black Americans, you know, can't vote, can't find the polls, can't use the internet, you know, are suppressed, can't get an ID, or basically, I mean, the greatest racism I see, I call it projection racism. So projection racism is where liberal Democrats, particularly liberal white Democrats, project their racism onto Black Americans who they want to keep on the plantation, and they do that by dependency, by welfare, by a substandard education system, by substandard public housing, by doing everything possible to fulfill their self-fulfilling prophecy that Black people need to be cared for. You know, like farm animals. I mean, this is how I see the Democrats looking at Black Americans. And until that stops, until Black Americans start yelling and screaming, I mean, Candace Owens isn't enough. We need more people. We need, you know, every talk show saying, wait a minute, this is a bunch of nonsense. You know, and until that happens, until it hits the mainstream, this kind of propaganda is going to continue. And it's still going to play on liberal white guilt, you know, which is a racism in itself. If you feel guilty for racism that, you know, that you think somehow Black people are incapable of doing, you know, X, whatever X is, that is a form of racism too. And so the real racism are the people perpetuating these myths, not the what they're trying to say, the projected racism onto voter suppression, because there isn't any. You know, anybody can vote, you know, and so this is where we stand right now.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate the points that you made out. You're absolutely right. We need more forensic audits rather than recounting of all votes which contain fraudulent votes. And isn't it funny that you made mention that some ballots were submitted without an envelope? And another good point is that they're going to use a special paper in order to print ballots on. That would get away from the cases that we heard where a lot of ballots were Xerox copied, and someone said that even the country of China, it was sources there that provided ballots. So happy with what Georgia is doing. There's some other things that could be added to it, but it's a heck of a start.
Well, thank you. And the Georgia, if you want to look more into that Georgia law, you know, I've got a post on my website, but I know you can on my Facebook page, but I know you can dig more into it because I didn't cover all of it. If you find anything else of particular interest, because I think they're trying to do the right thing, I still think that they have to correct the previous election. Otherwise, you know, whatever they do in the future is window dressing, because the Democrats can still cheat. You know, they can still claim the vote fraud and suppression of the Black vote, and they have to be called on that. They have to be called on that to the major news sources that are perpetuating this racism. That's where really, you know, basically Black voters have to get loud, start yelling and screaming. And I'll do my best to scream too.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Greg.
Thanks, Pianki. We'll talk to you soon. Pianki is our new commentator at large for Action Radio. All right. So look, you call the show long enough, you get a title. That's just how it works around here. I don't know if I want to do a little bit more about this or do. I've got an article on Calvin Coolidge, which I think I might save for the next hour. But if you look at the title of the show today, what we're talking about is the national debt. And I I'll tell Michaela, because she's on the line too. I got a little bit caught because I spent way too much time last night finishing up. And this is what always happens. Look, you write a bill, you get to be a perfectionist. I'm writing my bill that reverses the liability immunity for vaccine manufacturers and makes them fully liable for their products, which is the way it should be. I mean, every other company is. You know, you think gum manufacturers aren't liable for their products if the products are defective? Not if they're used in a criminal case, but if they're defective, okay? And that's what we're talking about. So if the vaccine manufacturers are producing a defective vaccine, which is my contention with these messenger RNA things, then they should be responsible. You know, of the thousands of people who have died and the tens to hundreds of thousands who've been injured by these vaccines already, they need to be liable for that. You know, to not have liability means they can do what they want. You know, I mean, wouldn't you be more careful as a company if you knew there were financial consequences, you know, to you, your company, well, not you personally, because that's what a company is all about. The whole purpose of a company is to shield the people in the company from having their personal money be liable. So this is why a company is used to be called a limited liability, you know, company, proprietary limited, which I guess is the British terminology. And so companies are limited into the liability of what the company's assets are. So the personal assets of the people aren't touched. Now, in a partnership, that's different. personal assets can be gone after. But in a corporation, you know, they're not liable. The fortunes of the CEO and the board of directors and all those folks, you can't touch their personal money. You can only sue, you know, for the assets of the company. If the company goes bankrupt, then the company goes bankrupt, but the personal money isn't touched, okay? And I actually don't mind that, because otherwise nobody would go into business, you know, if their personal assets were on the line. What if my personal assets were on the line for everything I said here at Action Radio? Well, I guess maybe they can, because I'm not incorporated yet, but I'll work on that. Anyway, but point being, that's not a bad thing to have that. But with the vaccine manufacturers, not even the company is liable. I mean, they can do whatever they want. They can put anything on the market. You know, it's like a gambler. It's like the savings and loans people when they were bailed out. You know, it's the same logic. It's like if a gambler, you know, could bet anything they wanted, keep the winnings, but anything they lost was paid back to them. That's kind of where the vaccine manufacturers are right now. They can do anything they want. There are no losses to them, and any profits they make, they get to keep. That is insane in a free market. And part of the free market is the discipline that if you screw up, you're going to pay for it. Okay. Let me get back to this last little thing here. We've got about 4 minutes left, and then we'll get on to our Concerned Veterans for America and the national debt, which is going to be interesting. We're just waiting for Jimmy to join us, and when he does, we'll get going here. Wisconsin Assembly authorizes investigation of 2020 presidential election March 24th. This is in the Daily Wire. Wisconsin Assembly passed a resolution authorizing an investigation into the 2020 presidential election, et cetera, et cetera. We talked about that. In the end, Biden won. Well, he didn't win. He frauded. Let me state this properly. In the end, Biden frauded by only 20,682 votes, or 0.63% of the more than 3.2 million votes cast. See, this is what they do. Right? This is how vote fraud works. Right? So the election happens. You know, Trump was way ahead. They shut down the polls. They shut down the counting. They kick everybody out. They manipulate the vote, send in the voting machines, recalculate the numbers, do the stuff on the internet, you know, photocopy the votes, you know, a million times, whatever they need to do to get just over the line to have their candidate win. All right. Not too much, so it doesn't look bad, but just enough to win. All right. That's why it's only 0.63%. Back to the article. The resolution, opposed by every Democrat, of course, because they're vote stealers, gives Republicans who control the chamber the authority to issue subpoenas to compel testimony and gather documents. And that's from Representative Joe Sanfilippo, the vice chair of the Assembly Elections and Campaign Committee. See, this is where we're going to win this. It's Republican state legislative committees and state legislatures, you know, both houses and senates of the state of the states. This is where this is going to get turned around. All right. Article says Trump and his allies claimed there was voter fraud and other irregularities in the state. Well, I guess voter fraud could be considered an irregularity. But those claims were rejected by state and federal courts. That's not true. Okay, we got to make this really clear. The courts are not rejecting the claims. They're refusing to even look at the evidence. See, that's the difference. It's being reported that the courts have overturned or rejected the arguments and all that kind of stuff. That's not true. Okay. You look at most of the courts, they're refusing to even look at the evidence. All right. So that's a dereliction of duty. That's a fault. That's a flaw. That's basically judicial misconduct to refuse to look at obvious evidence staring them in the face because they don't want the outcome. All right. That's deciding the case without, you know, looking at the evidence. That's making up your own conclusion before you've even you know, taken a look at what's going on. That is judicial misconduct. All right. That's a problem. And that's why we're having you know, these issues going on here. All right. So back to the article. The U.S. Supreme Court also refused to hear the case. Same problem. John Roberts shouldn't even be there. And no significant problems were found with the state's voting machines after audits and recounts in both 2016 and in 2020. The Associated Press reported. Well, of course, the Associated Press, you know, is a very much of a left wing, you know, group doing whatever they can to slant the things. Okay, I got Jimmy on the line. Let me just see if I can just tie up a couple of little numbers here to sort of put this in perspective. After his loss, Trump repeatedly claimed that voter fraud and ballot irregularities cost him the 2020 presidential election. That's something he should be saying every day, by the way. But a recount in a key county in Wisconsin, a battleground state, Joe Biden won, my term, fraudulently, by about 20,000 votes, found that the Democrat actually got more votes than originally reported. Really? Hadn't read this part. Out of about 460,000 ballots cast in Milwaukee County, Biden picked up an additional 132 votes. Before the recount, Biden had 300, after the recount, for Biden and 134,000 for Trump, which meant Biden gained 257 votes and Trump 125. Something wrong with that. there's something wrong with that because, well, I'll have to look more into this, because if they're just doing a recount, okay, then you, as we said before, that's not gaining anything. That's not a fair process, because you're recounting the fraudulent ballots. All right. So I just do a quick look here. This is what happens when you do multiple articles in the same show. Yeah, everything kind of blurs in your brain. Yep. Okay. They're just going back and forth. I'll take a look at it. I might have an election correction to my correction report in a little bit. All right. I'm going to play you one thing. We'll get on to our next hour here. And this is a busy morning. And again, I'm talking more, a lot more than I expected to, but that's how it goes. It's live radio.
To call any show on the Action Radio Network from anywhere in the United States, the number is 215-383-3832. To call any show from outside the United States using Skype, call 011, then 1-215-383-3832. We have many groups within Action Radio which will become laboratories for citizen legislation and serve as a place you can go for more specialized information. From the main Facebook page, Action Radio with Greg Penglis, at facebook.com/radiolegislature, you can check out our Action Radio news group, our vaccine project, the Family Law Project, the art project, the writer's page, the video page, our new student advocacy group, and many more groups that are coming soon. Remember, at Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news.
Yeah, especially when that vaccine bill starts making its way around. Again, I sent it to Dr. Zelenko, some other folks, and if we can reverse the vaccine liability and put it back where it belongs on the vaccine manufacturers, the whole world's going to change. All right, let me introduce some new friends of mine and new friends of the show, and let's get this going. Michaela Kerwin and Jimmy T. Smith. So Michaela approached me, I guess, maybe a month or so ago, and we started talking about this. And she and Jimmy work with a group called Concerned Veterans for America. We've talked about several things in the last few weeks, and they've kind of, you know, secured a spot on our Wednesday second hour. And whether it's 10 minutes or whether it's the hour, it just depends on what we're talking about. But there's a lot of things to be covered, as this group does a whole bunch of really neat stuff. And today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the national debt. So I'm going to make Jimmy's line live, I'm going to make Michaela's line live, and welcome you both to the show. And like I said, I've done enough talking for 1 hour. You kind of surprised me, actually. But you guys, yeah, tell me what you want to talk about. Let's start with Michaela. You can introduce yourself again for our new listeners, and then Jimmy, and then let's talk national debt. Michaela?
Hey, good morning, Greg. Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be on again. We are Concerned Veterans for America. I am the community engagement director for the Northwest region of Florida. We're a nonpartisan veterans advocacy group, so we look at things like VA, ending endless wars, and honestly, one of our biggest views is that our national debt is the biggest threat to the American way of life and the American people. So today we want to talk about the national debt. And Jimmy?
Sounds good to me. Yeah, Jimmy?
Yeah. Hey, thank you very much, you know, Greg and Michaela. Good morning. Good to talk to you again. And, you know, one of the things that that we're really concerned about, so, you know, the men and women who join the military and go off to war do not go off to war to protect America's ability to run us into debt and to, you know, spend. Matter of fact, one of the concerns that Concerned Veterans for America have is that, you know, the goal of our entire organization is preserving the freedom and prosperity that we and our families fought to defend. So when you think about it, these young men and women are going over there and their families are supporting them because they're preserving freedom. But quite often people forget that it's the American prosperity also that they're helping to defend. And we see that that's a major issue that's not talked about.
Yeah, is when you go into the military, I'm not sure exactly how much education they give you in political matters, but there was a book I found, and I somehow lost it, you know, several years ago, but there was a book that was given to soldiers in World War II. And I don't know if they all had to read it or it's just available, but it talked about our founding, and it talked about our founding principles, and it talked about the difference between a totalitarian Nazi government or a Japanese emperor dictatorship as opposed to our government, which is a constitutional republic. So the soldiers knew what they were fighting for. They knew the politics behind it. And it was a fascinating thing to see. And this would be a book, and I wish I could find it again, because I think it was endorsed by President Eisenhower, who was then General Eisenhower, in World War II. I think it's when it came out. But it really was a great education. So the soldiers were really taught what they're fighting for. In terms of let's talk about politics and economics, what kind of education does the soldier get today to know exactly what they are fighting for?
Well, absolutely none. The warfighting mentality is focused specifically on mission. As a matter of fact, it's been, and I was actually quite comfortable with this, it's been to the fact that we try to keep politics out of it, because you do not want a military that is too involved in politics. Now, we do talk about, the nation and freedom and these things, and I can tell you, having served for 20 years, that it is always a point of discussion. We would sit around waiting for training or after training or just in those voids of time where we had nothing to do, especially when I was over in the first Gulf War. We sat around a lot and we would talk about these issues, but there was never a top-down driven kind of concept of this is what you should know.
Yeah. I'm not saying you should be political advocates. I'm not saying you should make public statements. Obviously not. That's not what the military should do. But this is at a certain level. I think it makes sense to soldiers, especially new soldiers, as to what you're fighting for. And you made a really great point that I didn't think of before. A lot of great points I don't think of. But the idea that part of the fight for freedom is a fight for economic freedom, the ability to make a living, the ability to accumulate private property. That right, if we're invaded, if we lose our country, if we're taken over by whatever forces, we're not going to have that anymore. And so people don't understand that your way of life, your ability, your freedom, a large part of your freedom is wrapped up in your economic freedom. The house that you buy, the car that you buy, the places you can go, your life experiences, your memories, all those things, are part of economic freedom. They're all tied in. And I don't think people realize that. So that was a good point.
Well, this is one of the reasons that Michaela is constantly on the ground in Pensacola, because this is an issue. And Michaela, if you want to go ahead and jump in.
Mm-hmm. Feel free.
Sure, yeah.
So Michaela.
There's basically two ways that we look at tackling the national debt. One is we need to pursue responsible spending at the Department of Affairs. We would love to have an audit of what the VA is doing, what their budget is, how it actually breaks down, and I'm so sorry, I lost my train of thought. Where and how the dollars are being spent, exactly how the dollars are being spent. It should be subject to an independent audit so that we can examine how to slow the spending, because it is just out of this world right now. So that's one of the things. The other is we should protect American interests with SMART. And so the DOD, for instance, I want to say in the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act, funded the purchase of 14 more F-35s than the DOD requested at a unit cost of $100 million or more. That's crazy. We should not be spending that much money, especially when it's not even requested. And the F-35s are really, well.
Can we talk about the F-35 for a minute? Because this is one of my personal crusades. I've done shows on the F-35. It is a complete turkey. We have a Monday reporter that's absolutely fabulous. Not just this show, but he's a presidential advisor. He's worked with the CIA. He's done amazing work with nuclear weapons, and that's Dr. Peter Pry. And one of the things he told me is that stealth is a myth. There is no stealth. Okay, these airplanes can be seen easily on what they call low frequency long wave radar. So, in other words, short wave is where you have a very sort of, the amplitude, the size of the wave. Like, just think of it like an ocean wave, okay? It's really short and there's lots of them, millions of them, okay? Or however many cycles there are. But long wave, just think of like, Hawaii 5-0, the big wave rolling in, one big wave. All right. So think of radar in the same way. So you've got these big waves that are just out there, and they generate whole bunches of power behind them. Russians have all this technology. So the idea that an airplane is stealth is a myth, and most Americans don't know that. So we're spending billions of dollars on an airplane that's not stealthy, doesn't fly well, tries to do too much. They're trying to pack all these missions in one airplane. It doesn't work. The best analysis of aircraft I ever saw, and I'm curious what branch of the service you were in, you know, this will relate to this conversation, but this is guy Paul Sprague. He's a Canadian, and he's an aircraft analyst. He's the one that took part in helping to design the A-10 Thunderbolt, you know, the Warthog, the ground attack plane, and the F-16. And what he said was, if you want to have effective airplanes, and this goes for, I imagine, you know, tanks and ships as well, have them do one thing very well. The F-16 is the premier dogfighter when it came out. It was light, it was fast, it was maneuverable, had a couple of missiles and a cannon. It was great, but it was simple. It didn't have a massive radar. It wasn't weighed down. All right, this may get a little too carried away with my airplane stuff because I love them. All right, the A-10 is the perfect ground attack plane. It's got a titanium bathtub for the pilot. It's got this mungus gun out front that blows away stuff with depleted uranium shells. It's not supersonic. You know, it doesn't fly high and fast. It flies lower, slow, and is incredibly maneuverable and is the best at destroying tanks. But they're two separate airplanes that are designed for completely separate purposes. Then the folks come along and they try and make this airplane the F-35, which is the one answer for everybody. This will do everything. This will take off vertically. This can land on carriers. This can be stealthy. This can win a dogfight. This can be a ground attack plane. This can have a long-range radar. You know, this is a bunch of nonsense. And it reminds me of a plane, let's test your memories, guys, here, the F-111. And this is back in the 60s and 70s. There was an airplane called the F-111, which was the previous, this airplane will do everything, you know, from McNamara, you know, the genius that that said that the M-16 didn't have to be cleaned. You know, what a moron. So they've got this massive, they've got this new airplane project, which reminds me of another airplane project. And every time they do this, every time they have a plan for some airplane that can do everything, it never works. And yet, you know, they still spend billions of dollars, and there's a bunch of people that know that there is no stealth, that know that this doesn't work, that know that they're spending money anyway because that's their job, is to spend money. So if you guys want to go after something, go after the F-35. It's a freaking turkey. Just an opinion.
Well, that's one of them. And then Jimmy and I actually, we did a conversation about this in the summer about support allied defense capabilities, NATO, mm-hmm. that type of thing, bases overseas, and how there are, we have bases overseas that actually increase the GDP of the host country, say Germany, and we still don't see Germany paying into mm-hmm. NATO at the full amount. They're making more off the base being there, and we the American taxpayer are paying for Germany's GDP to be increased.
Yeah, that's called
foreign
aid.
Now, I'm not saying that there's no reason for us to have bases around the world, but we need to seriously look at it and make good financial decisions.
Well, I'll talk about that for a minute. I want to get back to
that. If my checkbook has to be balanced at the House, mm-hmm. why isn't the federal government's checkbook being balanced?
No, I want to talk about the airplane real quick, and I want to get back to that with Jimmy and both of you on the basis, because that's a concern of mine also. Jimmy, got anything to say on the F-35? Were you aviation involved when you were in the military?
No, I was a grunt. Matter of fact, I chuckled. Fortunately, I was on mute. I chuckled when you mentioned about McNamara and cleaning the M-16, because I've cleaned that darn thing more times than you could ever imagine and used every possible way to do it. And it was just a beast to keep clean. But if you didn't, it didn't work well. And, you know, your gun's got to work well on the ground. But the reality is that...
Go ahead.
That mindset is exactly what we try to bring to people's attention, is that you have these multi-$100 million planes or even tens of thousands of dollars that are invested in all this equipment on a soldier, from their rifle to their helmet to things like that. And really, the best thing, like you said, is to be frugal in your spending by making sure what you do does it well. So as an example, the B-52 is still around because nobody has designed anything that can even replace the B-52. And that has been a fiscally sound program in the Department of Defense that should be the example for fiscal spending going forward, to where when you have something, you invest in it, and it lasts, and we don't have to keep spending dollar after dollar. Matter of fact, there's a blogger, John Ubaldi, who is currently working on an article about all the waste that's been done in spending on these programs, from the Sergeant York to the Comanche to all these other things that end up never coming forward. You go back to the Bradley fighting vehicles and stuff like that, and how much, you know, it was a $1 billion investment just in the research to put together these weapons. So, you know, this
is a good point.
I
want to have a Bradley for a minute, because you've got a troop carrier that didn't have the thickest armor, like a tank, and it had a gun that wasn't the biggest gun, like a tank, and carry troops. What I would do is have a really good troop carrier without a gun, you know, behind a really big tank with a gun, with a bigger gun. You know, in other words, have the vehicle do what it does best. Have the tank be the escort for the troop carrier, and have them working together. That, to me, would make more sense than trying to make a hybrid, you know, gun-carrying troop carrier that doesn't do either of those things very well. What do you think?
Well, you look at the Striker Brigades that they ramped up, and the Striker Brigades are wheeled vehicles. And what we found is that in the military, of course, you have to move very quickly. But tank vehicles do have limits, and they are high maintenance. Wheeled vehicles do have some challenges in certain environments, but as an example, the Striker has been really good at moving fast. Now, it's low armor, but the reality is, for you to hit a target that's moving that fast, you have to have an incredible system. And when you look at the geopolitical aspect of our potential enemies, very few to almost no countries have the ability to really hit us when we're moving on the battlefield at full force. So it is all about, though, the spending smartly. And back to Michaela's point, you know, CBA has been advocating for us to really look at the DOD spending. And Michaela, if you want to really jump on that again, because you were spot on, and maybe lead into the discussion about the bases, because
DOD spending
on weapons and bases, it's all American taxpayer dollars.
Michaela?
Yeah, I'm here. So like I was saying, we have bases still in Germany, Japan, and those are remnants from World War II and unconditional surrender. We said, well, we're going to stay and make sure things go all right. But we're still there now, and that's been 80 years.
At what point is enough?
Exactly.
What's the justification? What's CVA's position that's concerned Veterans for America? What's your guys' position on these bases that are remnants of 1945? You know, are we still going to be there in 2045?
Our alliance relationships are important, but our prosperous European partners are better able to defend themselves than ever through NATO. So if they would just commit to NATO, pay their actual dues to NATO, we could redirect the $5.4 billion a year, four-year annual average spent on the European Defense Initiative. It would promote more capabilities and it would promote more capable allies and force them in their own military forces.
Why don't we share bases? In other words, why don't we share German bases? So Germany pays the rent. Germany, you know, builds the infrastructure. We share a base. Maybe we pay a portion of the cost, you know, for the portion of a base that we have. But there's no reason to have a fully independent American base in Germany right now, you know, especially when we talk about tactical
and
nuclear
fact,
weapons that other countries have.
We pay them rent. In fact, it's the opposite. We pay them rent to have the base there.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but what I'm saying is if we share a base, that rent's going to be cut dramatically. You know, there's no reason for us to have fully independent American bases in Germany. That makes no sense to me. So I'm wondering if you guys, you know, have a policy or would think about, you know, sharing. You know, when we went in the Gulf War, and this is probably more Jimmy's area, we had carrier planes, you know, flying, but a lot of planes were flown from bases that were borrowed. You know, that were by treaty. I don't think we built entire airfields in the Gulf War. If we did, let me know. That would be a huge expense also. But the thing is, you know, with treaties with other countries, we can use their bases when we need them. We don't have to maintain a base. You know, why are we in Okinawa? You know, I mean, unless it's something for North Korea. And then I would understand it, but let's have an offensive, you know, missile defense or missile offense capability, you know, there. But we don't need an entire aircraft brigade. Carriers, for example, they're vulnerable to missile attack. You know, if we go into the South China Sea with aircraft carriers, you know, five aircraft carriers can be taken out by five Chinese missiles. Okay, I disillusion people, but aircraft carriers are borderline obsolete at this point. It's a scary thing to think about, but it's true. Okay. So we don't have our priorities. We don't maximize our ally alliances. You know, NATO should be funded by the people who are there, you know, in the North Atlantic. Europe should be funding almost all of NATO. We should be borrowing bases when we need them, given current situations. It doesn't take long to, you know, because we have to move stuff over when we do stuff anyway. Who wants to comment?
Well, you know,
shared
Greg,
bases. Yeah,
well,
Jim.
One of the things,
Jimmy.
Though, when you look at this, so mm-hmm. you have to put it in context. So
okay.
when you look at the national debt clock as an example, you go there, and I was doing a little research prior to this discussion. I mean, we're just ever increasing the cost of our defense and military,
mm-hmm.
and it's obviously not just the modernization that we have to go through that we
yeah.
talked about and the wasteful spending there, but
mm-hmm.
it really is finding every dollar. So every troop from Joe EIOU1 private to the highest ranking officer in the, you know, in the military will tell you there's obviously waste in the military, but it's not a really from bottom to top or top down concept of hunting down and preventing that waste. So as an example, when I was overseas, the mindset was is that we had ammunition. Well, we had to go to an area and blow this ammunition off. Now, we're literally just wasting money by shooting bullets into a ravine and grenade launchers and you know, or grenades from the 203 and the AT-4 missiles and LAW rockets, and we're just shooting them at this wall. I mean, don't get wrong, lots of fun, but not what the military should spend. So the
why
question
are you doing
was,
that?
Why?
Well, yeah.
So me being the person I was, I asked, and they were like, well, if we don't shoot this, we can't get more. So you have to use the ammo to be able to, in the mindset of government, get more ammo.
But you already have ammo.
Exactly. There you go. Welcome to my world.
Well,
you know, this
is
why I got involved in government in the first place. But, you know, but as an example, think of all that money. So you have however many bases in the panhandle that basically that money can be strongly invested in if they didn't have to go through this procurement process
mm-hmm.
that was not as frugal as it should be. We'll be polite, not as frugal as it should be.
But very polite.
You have all those, yeah. You have all those bases with that mindset. You need to have every single base there, making sure that the money they spent is a needed dollar and
mm-hmm.
not be afraid to spend the money. I mean, obviously, you know, the B-52 was a great investment, but on the other side,
yeah, but the B-52 can be shot down with a missile. I mean, B-52s were shot down in Vietnam. B-52s,
right,
and that was
but,
back in the 70s. It's a vulnerable airplane.
Right.
It only works in a
but
non-missile environment. What's that?
Right, all of them are. Everything that we have is vulnerable. There's no such thing as a military weapon that's not. Sand
well, okay.
stops an M16, okay? So the key point, though, is that with all the bases that's there, they should be going through every single level of every single base and trying
mm-hmm.
to find the most frugal way of doing it. If there's a way to, you know, privatize something in their supply chain, then do it. If there's a way to get it down to the lowest command level to provide them the ability to get it cheaper, they should do it. I'm not saying they're not, but if they aren't, they should be.
Yeah. We're going to get on the national debt in a minute. I want to get back to Michaela, though, on the bases. Do you remember the Base Closure Commission? This was several years ago. It was an all-or-nothing list, and they put I think the Pentagon put a bunch of bases on the list. I've forgotten who was president at the time. And the vote in Congress was, you know, because people in Congress, they want a base in their district so they can get federal money, you know, and that's part of the problem, too. Beg your pardon?
I said that's a huge part of the problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you have, like, a base closure recommended list, and that includes foreign bases? Are you guys working on something that says, we don't need this base anymore, this is a bunch of nonsense, like, I don't know, Okinawa, Diego Garcia, Greenland, where else are we?
I would have to get back to you with that on that, Greg. I don't,
yeah.
I do not have a base closure list that CVA has prioritized, to my knowledge.
Okay.
That's Congress's job. Congress should be looking at that.
Well, it should.
CVA has not done that. But I don't want to like totally get off of the bases, but I think we've said a lot about it. The next thing, though, is, and I know I harp on it all the time,
mm-hmm.
we have got to stop funding endless wars.
Yeah.
Like, Afghanistan has been called the place where empires go to die.
Well, I'm sure you've got a statement on
conquer Afghanistan.
Yeah.
The Russians couldn't conquer Afghanistan. Why do Americans think that we're going to do it? The annual cost of the war in Afghanistan is $45 billion. If we use $45 billion, we could do the infrastructure repairs that every single president has promised that they're going to do. 1 year of Afghanistan spending could clear the Federal Highway Administration's estimated backlog and do the infrastructure project that every president for years and years has promised they're going to do.
So where's the
cost,
backlog? Who's behind
this?
I'm sorry? Who makes money off Congress spending money on wars? Because I'm convinced there's a permanent war class, like the John Boltons of the world. They want war. You know, Biden, who's nothing, who has no idea what's going on, has just reauthorized, they're not pulling the troops out of Afghanistan. Like you're saying, it's stupid. There's no reason to be there. There's nothing to win. I think that they're there specifically because they know they can't win, but they can spend money. And that seems to be the goal. It's like building the F-35. It doesn't work, but it's a great way to spend money. And the more money that's spent, the more that goes into the pockets of people that are in the permanent war class. Do you have a statement on that or a position on that? Let's get out of Afghanistan in particular, as soon as possible. That's a waste of money. It's a waste of lives. And that's the big problem.
Right. And if you're listening and you agree, please text Bring Them Home to 46262 if you agree that we should be bringing our troops home from Afghanistan permanently. No more boots on the ground in a hole.
Yeah.
it's the whole of a country. So
yeah,
I'll make that shameless pitch there.
Here's the problem, though. But if you look at military spending, as extravagant and wasteful as it is, a lot of it's authorized by the Constitution. There's a lot of spending that isn't authorized by the Constitution, like entitlements, for example, which is the biggest part of the budget. Social Security, Medicare, all the any kind of welfare, none of that is constitutionally allowed. It's just not, but yet there it is. And so you want to look at places that's got the budget.
What politician is going to come out and say something against that? What politician is going to come out and say something against that, especially like in Florida?
Hence the purpose of Action Radio, to write the law, to change it. We have a bill to end welfare. It's going to take a 20-year process, but we have a way to do that. So I want to get on the national debt for a bit, and I also want to bring up my favorite president, Calvin Coolidge, because he cut the budget in half and cut the national debt in half. So it can be done. And he had every bit of as much objection as today. He just didn't have the media opposition, so it's probably easier for him to do it. But can you, both of you, take a minute and kind of explain what the national debt is, and if you can distinguish that from the deficit. I think there's a lot of confusion. People are always getting these things mixed up. And if you can paint a picture of what is it, $27, $28 trillion it is now, put in perspective how much money that is. What's your position from CBA? What were they saying about it?
Well, when you look at the national debt and the deficit, so the deficit is the matter of, and mind you, I'm not an economist, and this is just a good redneck kind of education I have on this issue from years of watching politics. But the debt is what we owe other people. The deficit are our ability to pay our bills. So, in a redneck way of describing it, but the whole aspect of $28 trillion is basically meaning that, Greg, right now you owe, the federal government about $220,000+. So I don't know when you're going to write that check. I'm sure they're expecting it shortly. But, that also means that the children that are being born today have to now get a job, go to work, and pay this money. And people think, whenever it comes to the debt and all this, and the Keynesian mentality of who cares, we're all going to die anyway, it doesn't matter. Well, if you look back at what happened with Greece, and one of the key things that happened was that they scaled back all these projects. So now imagine, and you go back to the entitlements, now imagine you and I cannot write that check. So the ability for us to pay that debt to these foreign countries. So if the interest goes up or if they want to start calling in their markers, so to speak, and if we had to write a check to pay this off, we wouldn't be able to do it. And at some point, we would literally have to go in and the Medicaid and the Social Security and the defense and everything and all these pork projects and the arts and all these other things that we're spending money on would have to be drastically cut like it was in Greece. And right now we just see people going to government wanting more and more and more. And imagine at some point in the future that we would have to tell, you know, whoever it is, you can't get any more government money. We're going to stop it. So you're getting TANF, which is TANF and WIC and SNAP, which is food stamps, which is welfare, and which is money for young families. And we start telling that young mother that we know you're in a difficult situation and government has always told you we're going to be there for you, but guess what? That you were getting from us, we can't give you that anymore. The country would turn into turmoil. We have so addicted our American people to asking our federal government to provide more money to make their life easier. And so as an example, when I was a state legislator, I worked on the entitlement system within the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. And there was almost $700+ million of known fraud. Okay, they knew that the system was being defrauded up to this percent. We had 40-something investigators that were able to work on just 10% of the cases. Just 10% of the cases. So that mm-hmm. meant that there was hundreds of millions of dollars in the TANF, in the SNAP program, not Medicaid and Medicare, but just in those two programs that was being defrauded. And they know it was because these reports are coming in, the money's going out. And people are getting mad because we want to rein that in. I put penalties on white-collar criminals and stuff through legislation. And people were mad at me. Well, we don't need to do that. The system's not broke. Look at California. We gave so much money to them for the unemployment system out of these stimulus programs, and there's potentially billions of dollars that are being defrauded, and we're never going to get that money back. So that means your check that you have to write got bigger because somebody else stole the money that then later on we can't help out truly needy people. And that's what happens when the U.S. national debt ramps up to the point of default. We're going to end up seeing American people suffer.
What's that going to look like? Let's talk about default. I had a great article, actually a great interview with Dr. Walter Williams when I first started in radio full time back at WBY back in 2017. Michaela has that interview. I want to talk to Michaela about this too. But the idea of default, you know, when the economy collapses, not if, but when, what is that going to look like? I don't know if you guys have studied that, but Michaela, did you get a chance to listen to that interview? And what's your comments on national debt?
I mean, I did get to listen to the interview. I listened to it last night, actually. Great interview. It's very interesting. But I thought it was interesting how he said the interest rates are going to continue to rise. Mm-hmm. And that's going to – I mean, that's going to – what is that going to look like? Or it's going to slow the housing market, which right now is red hot, which, I mean, that's not something to be usually talked about, the housing mm-hmm. market. But it's going to – I mean, look at – if you – what is it going to look like? Look at any country that has an inflated currency. Look at the Naira in Nigeria. Look at Venezuela. Look at these countries where they have just gone into inflation, because that's what the rising interest rate is going to do. It's not going to be a pretty picture for the American people if we don't get our budget under control now.
Yeah, I want to talk about where it's actually owed. I want to make a little suggestion of a better way to understand, I think, the deficit versus the national debt. The deficit is the yearly difference between how much money the federal government takes in and how much money the federal government spends. That would be Congress, because Congress spends the money. So if they take in, you know, usually they take in $4.5 trillion in revenue. And if they spend, $5.5 trillion in money, you've got a $1 trillion deficit, okay, for the year. The national debt is the accumulation of every year's deficit. So each year you're adding to the national debt. The national debt used to have a debt ceiling. In other words, they could spend no more money than a certain amount, and Congress would do that. They have done away with the debt ceiling. Nancy Pelosi did away with it. And what they said was that spending more than the debt ceiling authorizes a new debt ceiling. So in other words, the spending is authorized by doing the spending. And the whole idea of us not being able to pay our bills, there, people get that backwards, I think, because, you know, the reason that we have the bills in the first place is because they spent money they didn't have. They have to borrow it. So if you want to, you know, keep the full faith and credit in the United States, you have to stop the spending. This is a spending problem. These people are addicted to spending. So what we need to do is bring back a debt ceiling. I would actually lower the debt ceiling and say you have to cut the budget down to the debt ceiling. That's a position I hope you guys, the Concerned Veterans of America, would take and say, look, this is insane. One of the things I asked Dr. Walter Williams, and I ask anybody, Grover Norquist when he was on from, I forgot, with Americans for Lower Taxes. I probably butchered the name of his organization. But anybody who has any economic knowledge that comes on the show, I always ask the same two questions. How much national debt can this nation support? And, of course, the answer is, I don't know, which leads to the second question, which is even more important. Well, if you don't know how much debt this nation can support, why are you increasing the national debt? In other words, it's economic suicide. They're pushing us to a place they don't know, and they won't know until it happens. But do you want to wait for that point? Because once it happens, it's too late to go back before that. You can't you know, back the clock up. You can't say, "Whoop, there's the point at which we're going to, you know, lose it all." You know, let's stop just before we get there, because nobody knows where just before that is. So it's a combination of economic treason and economic irrationality. What we're doing, the idea of spending money, not knowing how much money. Yeah, go ahead, Jimmy.
Well, Greg, go ahead, Mikhail.
I'll give you both a chance. Who wants to go? You guys can both talk. We got time.
You go, Jimmy.
Okay.
We'll take turns.
So one of the things that I go back to what I previously said, so our mission is preserving the freedom and prosperity that we and our families fought to defend, right? So with that mindset, you have to think about it. As we're talking about what is the impact on the family. So, you know, we're talking about the potential for prices to rise exorbitantly within the United States for basic goods, like example that Michaela gave earlier. But also, you have to think about it. What that means is it also affects our ability to have a safe country. So, you know, Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the former chairman for Joint Chief of Staff, I believe, so he was one of those ones who was very adamant that the debt is the greatest threat to our national security. And if I remember correctly, in one of General James Mattis's speeches, he was very emphatic that the incredible growth of our debt and is basically a debt to the children is also going to be a debt. So when you think about this, the long-term planning that is going on for the military is based off of our ability to generate revenue. Okay. And yes, we want to be, you know, scaled back. We want to be smart. We want to make sure we're not going to wars. We don't need to. But in the end, we also need planes and tanks and ships and all these wonderful things, missiles and technologies and nuke and all that. If we don't have a strong economy, we can't pay for that. Now imagine at some point, if we now can't feed our families because we don't have enough money and the government can't provide assistance to those families, they're obviously going to have to scale back things within the military. So I served in Panama during the Clinton years, and it was so bad, Greg. It was incredibly bad. Our budgets were scaled back so much that it felt it on the ground. So we're in Panama. We're doing training because, you know, we're there to defend the Panama Canal and all this great stuff. And we were literally running around playing army because when we went out to train to take down a building, we didn't have blanks to do our dry fire or our rehearsals, right? So instead of running around and pulling a trigger and having that blank going off and simulating you actually firing the rounds, they were like, well, just run up and yell bang, bang. I was just flabbergasted. I could not believe it. This is where we're at. We had NCOs in the positions of privates because we were not recruiting enough people to fill positions. The units were reduced. But when that one particular situation arose in my life to where they told me, well, we don't have blanks, just run around and yell bang, bang. I really felt it was the stupidest thing possible. So when I come around the building, somebody yelled bang, bang as I'm running up to them, I just yelled near miss, and kept going. So the reality is, you know, this does affect our national security. If you can't train on the ground in a realistic way, you're not going to be able to defend freedom and prosperity. And the national debt is correlated directly to our freedom and prosperity, our ability to be able to defend our nation, that then allows us to grow our economy and provide services to our citizens. And when people just keep saying, well, you know what, send us more money. And right now, this stimulus concept where they're just giving money out, we have people that are in our community getting unemployment, getting stimulus money, getting not having to pay rent, and so much more that are basically, we have help wanted signs out. And we don't have people applying for these jobs. And we're everything from the server and the restaurants to decent jobs that are $15, $20 an hour jobs. And in my community, it's a pretty good job. You know, painters, constructions, and things like that. And we can't fill these positions because right now people are just getting free money, as they see it, from the government, which is ramping up our debt, which is putting us in a position of national security to where we potentially could have a less secure and stable military in the future. And nobody ever looks past today. Well, I get up in the morning, the sun rose, that's all I care about. We have to think long-term when it comes to this. We have to stop the American people being short-sighted and really start looking into the aspects of, do we want to preserve the freedom and prosperity that our veterans served for? Do we want to really have a free country and a prosperous country? Or do we want to just keep looking to government to keep writing us damn checks so we can sit at home and binge watch or play games all day long? And that's currently what I see a lot is happening right now, and it needs to stop.
Makes sense to me. Michaela?
Makes perfect sense to me. I agree 100%. I got my first job when I was 15 and I haven't stopped working since. I love to work. I don't even understand the idea of not wanting to work or just getting free money. I really enjoy.
Well, that's fairly new.
Doing something to earn it,
you know.
And Jimmy's right. Yeah. Everywhere here in the Panhandle, everywhere around here, everywhere says now hiring. Chick-fil-A, Target, Panda Express, everything now hiring, now hiring, now hiring. So if you're, if you're having trouble with money, go get a job, buddy.
Or two.
Don't keep asking the government for it. Don't keep asking the government for it. But I want to go back to something that we touched on at the top of the hour, but we haven't really come back to is the VA. And if you compare spending across every federal agency over the last 10 years, excluding the growth in the interest payments on our federal debt, no other department comes even close to competing with the VA's 100%, you heard that right, 100% budget increase. And in 2011, Congress passed the Budget Control Act, and the only department-level agency where all discretionary spending was exempted from potential cuts or sequestrations was the Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, I'm not saying I'm saying that's wrong. Every person should be, or every federal agency should be audited. They should be looked at, and they should have a budget. There should be a reason we are spending this money. The VA budget for 2021 is already record breaking, and so I say some of that is because we are in an endless war with Afghanistan. We have to cut the pipeline off that is really suffocating the VA. We also need to make sure the VA is spending their money wisely and we're not going through more and more scandals like we saw in Phoenix 7 years ago. I think we're almost 7 years to the day. It was April of
Well, you want to talk about sacred spending. You know, if you say it's for the veterans, I mean, that's almost a guarantee that the money's going to go through. Excuse me.
Correct, but in 2018, we passed the VA Mission Act, which allows veterans to choose private care if they want to. If they're having to wait more than 20 days, which a lot of them were, and if they were having to drive more than 2 hours, they could seek care within their own communities. Now the VA is trying to walk that back because guess what? They don't want to be audited and find out that most of the money is going to the administration, not to the veterans.
Yeah, and that's
another point, though.
Jimmy, go ahead. Yeah, then we'll get back to Michaela.
Well, and another point on the whole VA spending issue. So the VA spending, like she described, you know, doubled in the last 10 years. And in that, what was the output? So one of the biggest problems is that the VA is really trying to hold fast to everything they can and not really truly support the Community Cares Program under the Remission Act. And part of that is because it is a bureaucracy. Well, if we don't have a task and purpose, they may get rid of us. We're always going to have need for the VA. There is no doubt. There's going to be that aspect that the VA is going to be there. But right now, as the Community Cares Program was scaled back, we had doctors in the community. Let's go back to national debt a little bit. We had doctors in the community that if Community Cares Program was being used properly and they were funding the visits properly, these doctors actually during the pandemic saw a huge decline in their community in which some of the doctors had multiple offices and had to reduce their staff and shrink their staff because not enough people were coming in. So you had the veterans program, the Community Cares Program, that allowed veterans to go into the community. You had doctors who needed patients that would then allow them to keep people hired, put money back into the economy, and help out the community in that particular fashion. So here was the VA having a great opportunity to actually support a program that actually is strong in supporting the community as well.
Yeah.
But here's what you're finding. Yeah. They scaled that back. They purposely scaled that back. We specifically said this is going to be a problem. And right now, the backlog for these appointments are up to, or canceled, delayed, or moved appointments are up to almost 20 million. Okay, 20 million. Let me say that again. 20 million. And this is coming from the mouth of the Secretary of the VA himself, Secretary McDonough. Okay, not only that, you look at the backlog of compensation and pension exams, which are somewhat different. Okay, these are people retiring and stuff as well. And they're at 200,000. So here's this huge backlog. Here's this huge increase in the budget. And you know what they're saying? We need more money. Matter of fact, the Secretary of the VA in testimony to Congress actually talked about doing more stuff in the VA system instead of creating a better VA system. They want to do more, and they already can't handle doing what they're doing.
Yeah, which brings me to a point I want to ask Michaela about. The CARES Act, the idea that that privatizing the medical services that the veterans can get either reimbursed by the VA or somehow, but they're allowed to get care, you know, wherever the best source of that care is. Would we be better off if the VA basically got out of the healthcare business, that they were just more like an insurance company, they had a reimbursement service, and veterans could always get private care or go where they wanted? Would that make for a better system? Then we could cut that part out of the VA budget. What do you think?
I don't think, like Jimmy said, I think that there will always be a need for the VA. I don't think that
I'm not getting rid of the VA.
Privatize it.
Just the VA health services privatized. VA hospitals privatized. In other words, allow veterans to get care wherever they want, but you know, and the VA would be like a health insurance, you know, place where people would get their reimbursements.
I don't agree with that because that you're talking about privatizing even the hospitals. And there are plenty of veterans who live close to a VA hospital and get good treatment. They like that. And so,
okay.
So I don't think that would be a solution necessarily.
So
I think that we have to look at the fact that, you know, when your patients are only growing by 3.6% and mm-hmm. you have department personnel growing by 12.5%, that was from fiscal year 14 to fiscal year 17.
Okay.
So why do you need 12.5% more staff if you only have a 3.6% increase in patients? So those kinds of things are the things that need to be addressed at the VA. I don't think we necessarily need to turn it into a TRICARE. We have that already. I don't know exactly that would be the answer.
Jimmy, what would you do?
So one of the things, though, it's not about what I would do, okay? Because look, if I had a blank check, life would be so much different for so many people, and I would, you know, really believe in the whole aspect of, you know, participation in everything that you do. So what you got to look at is what are they doing? So as an example, during the testimony in Congress, though, the secretary basically talked about needing millions of dollars more to basically do the copayments. Okay, so we talk about the community cares. So they need more money to do the copayments. Well, what happened to the money that was funded for the copayments in the first place? Because money was put into the budget for that in the past. Where's the money at? Okay. Not only that, they want to do construction grants and stuff like that for the state homes to improve health care. But here's where we're finding a problem. Okay. The homes, when they are built, these government contracts, when they're done, okay, so mm-hmm. now, mind you, they're asking for more money to do these things. If you research any of these buildings being built, they always have cost overruns. They never, ever are done at budget or below budget. Not only that, to hire a just CNA, if you're a private sector CNA or you're a government CNA, your salary can be comparative, right? But to hire you, you are going to be more expensive if you go to work for the government, if you go to work for the private sector. Now, your paycheck will probably be the same, but the cost of employment, whenever you have somebody who works for the government, the cost of employment is higher. So, you know, the goal here is to look at all of this realistically. What is the best possible outcome for the veteran? It always goes back to the veteran when we talk for healthcare. We talk about choice because we want the veteran to have the choice that's best for them. The money should follow the veteran. It's just like school choice, okay? It is the veteran who is the issue. We don't need to spend lots of money on new buildings. We don't need to provide a larger VA concrete infrastructure. We need to actually look at the reality of when we did that in the past, the reason we did that is there was lack of hospitals and clinics. So right now, as an example, last year, President Trump talked about potentially building a clinic in Jacksonville. And here's where I'll tell you it lit my hair on fire. Where is the need? If the community cares program was properly funded, as it was in the budget, and the money went through and they paid all the doctors like they're supposed to, there's a more than enough doctors in the community. We do not have to build another VA facility. We do not have to hire another doctor in a specialty care for the VA. They can very simply go to the local community and get that same care. But the mindset is that elected officials and even President Trump, who, you know, I think was very supportive of veterans, basically had that mindset. Well, we need to do something for them. Give them opportunity. Give them choice. Treat it like education. Here's your check. Go get your care. Matter of fact, Congressman Greg Stubbe has what is called the Veterans True Choice Act. So it kind of goes back to your point earlier about almost like a TRICARE. And that doesn't hinder the VA from providing care, but then it takes community cares to that next level of basically saying, we now can either choose to go to the VA or permanently be enrolled in a support the civilian kind of thing like a TRICARE. Okay, so
what's TRICARE? Just
for
folks that don't
like
know.
That.
What's TRICARE?
Oh, very good question. TRICARE. So I served in the military, did 20 years, and that commitment from the government is that they would provide me health care insurance for the rest of my life. So TRICARE.
Okay.
And it is contracted through Humana. So TRICARE Humana is who's doing it now. And there's somebody prior to Humana, and who knows in the future what it will be. It is not to where there's no copays or anything. My wife just had surgery, minor surgery, and it cost us $1,000 out of pocket, which is fine because it is our health care and we should pay our due part. But the reality is that TRICARE is a type of insurance after you've done 20 years or if you've been, if I'm correct on this, after you've been medically retired as well. That's why the term retirement is so very important to veterans. That's why you don't stop at 18 years and get out. You go 20, so you hit that retirement and get taken care of in that aspect of health care. And the Veterans True Choice Act would potentially create the same kind of system that you can either go to the VA if you like it as it is, but you can also choose to instead have an insurance style where basically you're going to whatever doctor in whatever community. It's not about travel. It's not anything. It's about the veteran. And
well, that's what
it's almost like school choice.
Yeah. I mean, if the facility works, that's fine. Yeah. How big is the VA a budget? How much do these folks spend every year? Do they have a fiscal year figure for me? I'm just curious.
I do.
I'll Google that while we're talking.
It is,
okay.
Sorry?
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
You got the numbers. Yeah, I'm curious.
Oh, yeah. It's exceeding $240 billion for fiscal year 2021.
Okay, so the defense budget is about what? Defense budget is about $800 billion? Just curious.
The defense budget...
Or is it a trillion yet?
Budget is in the trillions. I don't have an actual... Okay, hold on. I do have a stat for you on that. Fiscal year 2020, it was $738 billion defense budget.
So it's not even $1 trillion. This is the point I want to get to.
No, it's not $1 trillion.
For the national debt, we defend our country with less than $1 trillion, and that includes Afghanistan, you know, and all these other places, right? I mean, that's all part of the defense budget. This is where it comes out of. So
right.
All the bases,
so
all the carriers, all the
is $45 billion.
Okay, so the turkeys like the F-35 and all these the crazy things that we're funding that I don't think help our national security or our national defense, you know, come out of this budget that's less than $1 trillion, okay? See, I don't think people realize that. And if you read the Constitution, you know, I talked to Dr. Walter Williams about that. I said, well, what's an actual constitutional breakdown? How much should we be spending? And he said, you know, you take your basic $1 trillion, $700 billion would be military and whatever the budget was, 70% military, you know, 20%, you know, infrastructure and about 10% everything else, which would be, you know, the Supreme Court, the Patent Office, the, you know, the various offices of the federal government. But all the stuff that we have, you know, the biggest problem, the reason we can't spend money on national defense is the entitlements. That's the budget part that's taking up the most, and that's not even constitutional. So if you really, I'm thinking, this is a message to concerned veterans of America. If you really want to look to increase the defense budget, you know, or at least have national security from a secure economy, let's look at the things that shouldn't even be there. And I did something, Mikhail, I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at it, and I can send it to Jimmy also. I did a project. And this is something that I think CVA, Concerned Veterans for America, would find very interesting, is that I took the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 are the actual delegated spending powers of Congress. In other words, where they can spend the money. And I took each section and clause and fit, you know, from the federal budget, the departments that fit that category. And I came up with a budget of about $1.5 trillion, you know, for the year that I did it. The federal government takes in $4.5 trillion, roughly. All right. So basically, there's a $3 trillion surplus every year from what they spend on the constitutional issues, all right, and what they take in. So that $3 trillion could actually be used to pay down the national debt if we stuck to strictly a constitutional budget. But what that means is no entitlements. And I'm not talking about, you know, things that are funded like Social Security, but there's all these other things that are in there that are spent beyond that. I'm not sure, you know, where it works, but Social Security wasn't included in this budget at all. And I don't know if that is funded strictly through taxes or how they're doing it. But when they say the trust fund's running out of money, that's a big problem. But the thing is, if we really take a look at the federal budget and we look at the things that are constitutional, it's not that big a deal. It's not that much of a budget. And the military is, you know, the biggest expense is the military because that's the greatest place where things are authorized. You know, Congress shall maintain an army and a navy. And these days, let's assume an Air Force and a Space Force, you know, to defend the country. That's most of what the Congress should be working on when you look at it. And yet we defend this country with less than $1 trillion and we're about to spend $2 trillion on what? Roads? That's where the priorities ought to be. Take a look at the overall budget. Defense isn't that big a part of it. People don't realize that. I want to know.
Well, you know, so yeah, and I know we're coming up to time to wrap up and everything. We have other meetings to go to, but so let me rehash this and Michaela can close. You know, again, the Concerned Veterans for America focus, our mission, is preserving the freedom and prosperity that we and our families fought to defend. Mm-hmm. Michaela, in the Panhandle, is your subject matter expert on, as you heard her talk about, the budget, on the VA, and on the aspects of engaging on the endless war. So with that, Michaela.
Yeah, so
you got
I'd
a minute.
Say
the last minute's yours.
Number one, Congress should audit the VA. and make sure that the expiring that the VA is using the money that they've been given to properly treat patients. Make sure that we don't have patients waiting in parking garages like we do down in Tampa, and that the money that they've been given is not being used to just grow personnel and bureaucracy. So that's number one. Number two, we have to take a look at, as we have talked the entire hour on, we have to take a look at the national debt. And for CVA, we look at that through a veterans lens, continue the DOD audit, audit the VA. And number one, stop throwing money at endless wars. I cannot say this enough. The total cost of the post 9/11 wars through fiscal year 2020 was $6.4 trillion. If we would just leave Afghanistan on May 1st and honor the Doha Agreement that the Trump administration gifted to the Biden administration, we would save $45 billion a year.
Yes. I got to hold you there. We're actually off the air. We've run out of time. Well, let's pick it up next week because that's a huge thing to talk about. If you can just give the information, contact information, I have to let you both go. This has been a fabulous hour.
Okay. So please text, bring them home to 46262.
There we go. All right. Thank you both. Let's do it again next week. This is Greg Penglis for
Thank
Action
so
Radio.
Much,
oh, you're very welcome. At blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. And Jimmy and Michaela will be back next week and we can continue this conversation.